Hi! If you're a fan of Nonprofit Lowdown, you might be interested in my weekly free newsletter where I send out weekly inspiration for fundraising, notices about any upcoming events that I'm doing, and a cute dog picture. So check it out at rhegawong.com, rhegawong.com. Welcome to Nonprofit Lowdown. I'm your host, Rhea Wong. Hey, podcast listeners, Rhea Wong with you once again. This must mean that it is Nonprofit Lowdown. Today, I am talking about the philanthropy revolution with Lisa Greer. She is a philanthropist, best-selling author of The Philanthropy Revolution, changemaker, advisor, and passionate about the nonprofit space. So Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
Before we jump into the details, because you and I have so many things to talk about, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background in philanthropy, and really what inspired you to write The Philanthropy Revolution, which, by the way, I read before you and I had met, and I was a bit of a super fan. Really exciting that we get to chat today.
Thank you. So as you read in the book, and maybe some of the people on have not, I grew up as a basically average kind of middle-class person living in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. And as a kid, we really didn't use the word philanthropy. It wouldn't have been used in our house at all because that sounded like people with attitude and people who just weren't us, that kind of thing. So that wasn't even used. Our family, I'd call them philanthropic. We gave, but it was really local things, PTA. And I remember doing like a pen pal thing for CARE because people in Africa or something when I was little, but it was really not a piece of our life. You do good things through Girl Scouts, whatever. When I was in college, we did things through my sorority, but it was all very vague and like you just send the money off somewhere and that kind of thing, unless it was hyper-local, like it was Girl Scouts. My husband grew up in a very similar way in Toronto, and basically about 12 years ago, after really being the volunteer for things, because I would say, I want to get involved. And people would say to me, that's lovely, honey, and pat me on the head and say that you can volunteer for this because we didn't have enough money for that kind of stuff. I have five kids. I was most of the time we were dealing with our family and we were always working, both of us. And about 10, 12 years ago, the company that my husband had started about 10 years before that went public. We had a very successful public offering. And to give you an idea of the time frame, the exact same day we went out was the same, went public was the same day that Tesla went out. So my husband would actually see him at all of these meetings back and forth because they were all meeting with the same people. I had a business. I'm a serial entrepreneur, but as is my husband, but I also worked for the studios for a long time and set up different businesses within Universal Studios and NBC and in the music business and various things. But it was always work and you give what you can give. And like I said, most of the time it was more volunteer. And then I had a business in the fertility business that I had started that was helping people create families and it was going well. I sold that. The company went public. He left. And all of a sudden we found out that we realized that we were embarking on this new life. And what was that going to be? And our biggest concern was that our kids not grow up to be jerks. That was we just kept talking to these attorneys and everything, just tell us how to do it so that we can make sure that our kids are not like that. But the very first thing that happened was it was about 10 days before the IPO happened. My husband has Crohn's disease, which he'd had since he was about 11. And I was very nervous about him traveling and going through all of this because it can be set off from stress. But we had one day they told us before I wouldn't see him until it either went public or it didn't. Like you don't know until it actually happens. And he was going to go off on this plane and go all over the place. And in 10 days, we would know. So we had this one day, it was quiet. I think the kids were taking a nap or something. And we were both really nervous. I was pretty shaky and making sure that what was this new life going to be? And how do we make sure that we say ourselves? I said, you know what we can do to help with this? Let's figure out where we want our first gift to be. And I have to say that I thought until a couple of years into this, that everybody who was faced with a windfall of money would say that. I just thought everybody gave. And I was very surprised to find that was not the case. Somebody had told me about donor advised funds, which is why I'm a big proponent of those because I got involved really early and it worked for us as our initial kind of foray into this. But I said, let's each pick something that we want to do that's really big. I don't think I called it a major gift. I think I said a big donation, something like that, because I didn't know the parlance at that point. I said, what would you want to do? Let's each pick something. We have enough. If this happens in 10 days, then what do we want to do? And so Josh said, well, I want to do something that helps with Crohn's disease to make sure that nobody has to go through what I went through. And I want to find out where the best research is being done to figure out what the genetic component is that makes all these people have this terrible disease. And I said, great, where do you want to do that? And I said, why don't we just do it at Cedars-Sinai, our hospital down the street where you had all your surgeries? And he said, no, I don't think they do research. So let's just do Stanford. I said, that's great. I can talk to them, but I think we should start locally and see what we find out. He says, fine, I'm done for 10 days. You go figure it out. Okay. He says, as long as it's going to have an impact. I think he might have used that word. And then he said, what do you want to do? And I was the incoming chair of our board at Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills. But we had a capital campaign going on. Again, I didn't know the word was capital campaign, but I knew that we had needed $1 million to finish it off. It was under construction, but we needed this $1 million. And there was a matching thing that happened at the end. And so I said, I want to give them the final $1 million before I take over as president. I think that would be really great as chair. And he said, well, okay, are you sure you want to do that? That's kind of a big thing. And then there's going to be like a building involved. And do you want to be that person? And I said, yeah, my father had, when I was about 12, I remember he died when I was pretty young, but he took me to a synagogue here in Los Angeles that he had been to and showed me a plaque where his father's name was on it because his dad had been the head of the board. I remember how proud he was. And I thought, I got to do this like for my dad. I think this is the right thing to do. So I picked up the phone and I called and I said to Josh, you know what? We can actually tell someone about this right now. We can't tell anybody on the Chrome side because we don't know who we're doing it with yet, but I could call right now and just say, we're going to give you the $1 million if this happens. I called my friend who was a senior rabbi there. She knew all about the IPO. We were very close. And I said, I just want to let you know that Josh and I have just had this conversation and we've decided that if this thing happens in 10 days, we're going to give you the final $1 million. I thought I was going to hear like Publishers Clearing House at the Door thing, that there was going to be balloons and stuff and people screaming and nothing. It was crickets, like absolute silence. And I said, hello, are you there? And she said, yes, but I don't know what to say. And I said, oh, well, I guess you could say thank you. And remember, I never thought those words would come out of my mouth in my entire life. She said, I don't know if I can say thank you because I didn't make an ask. And it was at that moment that it was like I became part of a bad movie or something. I was like, where am I in this place where people don't just say thank you? And it doesn't work like that. I don't understand. And then it got a little worse when she hung up the phone, didn't say thank you. We both went, she hung up the phone. Josh was looking at me like, why are you so white? What's going on? And the phone rings again. And she says, can I talk to Josh? And he's 10 feet away from me. And I said, okay. So I give him the phone and I figured she's just going to say thank you to him, I guess. And instead she said, are you aware of what your wife is doing? It was pretty unbelievable. Both of us were just absolutely shocked. And she's a staunch feminist. And I just said, I don't understand. Like, how can this be? And it ended. And he said, oh, okay. And he hung up the phone and that was that. Yes, I still gave the $1 million. Yes, I still was involved, but it did definitely affect my relationship, I think, with the synagogue. And I was very wary of how they did things. But I also felt like, is this normal? Do these kinds of things happen elsewhere? And over the years, as we did the other donations and got more involved in this and learned the language, I realized that that was in no way unusual. Maybe the exact pieces of what went together, but that this is something that happens all the time, often in various different extremes in an industry that has 1.5 million organizations in it, that is the third largest non-government employer in the country. This stuff is happening. And I've talked to people in other parts of the world and it happens there too. And I thought, who came up with these crazy rules and instructions? And why can't people just say thank you? I gave a few unsolicited gifts along the way and people got really confused. Like they weren't sure, like they talked to me, I was a criminal. Like, what? Who are you? I don't know. I heard about your organization. I saw a website. I sent you money and they couldn't deal with it. I thought, this is really strange. After a while, I realized, you know what? I don't need to work. Somebody who is in a position of not needing to work, who's aware of this stuff, needs to let people know how it feels to be a donor in this world. And then I thought, no, somebody else must be writing books and stuff talking about how the donor feels. And I found out nobody was. I talked to a bunch of donors. I'm like, why don't you talk about it? You've been giving for years. And they said, you know, it's easier to just hang up the phone on the person and not give to them. I said, but then you can't change anything. It's just going to keep going on this crazy way. I decided I became that person. And it's been, I have to say, glorious. It's been wonderful because I'm helping organizations change the way they do things based on how a donor hears things and how a donor interprets things. I did find out that, like I said, my experience is not that unusual. Every donor who I've ever spoken to has had, including a number of fundraisers, has had some quirky but weird and off-putting experience when they've been trying to give.
Okay, so much to unpack here because I'm just fascinated. Often, and I work with fundraisers, and I think one of the things that I'm really bullish on that I talk about all the time is not othering the donor, right? Especially in the nonprofit space, we have this tendency to think of like rich people as different than us, right? That somehow like they're different, they think differently, they act differently, and we either have to like kowtow to them or like we have to hold them at an arm's length because they might try to tell us what to do. I guess the question here, is that your perception? And if so, like how are you addressing that? Because my perspective is like, we're all just people, like, and some people are good people and other people are not so good people, but money only amplifies what you already are. But if you're weird about the money, you don't see the person.
It's great hearing you say that because it's exactly how I feel. It's interesting because I kept feeling that sort of othering thing. That people, they didn't know what to make of me. That's what it was. It was like they either are being pandering or they really think I'm an idiot. And so they're trying to get money out of me and think that I don't realize what they're doing or whatever it was. I do think it's exactly what you said, that I think people feel like they just don't understand this donor, this big weird thing from another universe. My husband's a member of the Aspen Institute, and they had spent some time reading Frederick Douglass stuff. Frederick Douglass, the people in the North brought him there to say, this is what a Black person looks like. So they wouldn't think it's like something that they've never heard of before. And obviously it was very successful. And he went from home to home and did these like salons. And I actually do a lot of salons myself. I decided that I would not to try and do the same thing, but based on what he did and that it was successful, that you know what? Somebody needs to get out there. And one day I'm going to bring some other donors and friends too and say, we're not scary. We're just regular people. I love the way you said that it's amplified who we are without changing who we are, and that we're not idiots and we're not scary. Are there a few scary donors? Sure. Are there a few scary fundraisers? Sure. Are there a few scary teachers? Yeah. But most of us are normal human beings who really have this communication break, I want to call it, or just this off-putting weird communication thing that happens between the two of you. And it's hard to do. And I've asked lots of donors, lots of fundraisers, like, why is that? Unfortunately, some of them have told me that they were told to treat donors that way.
Yeah.
And that's really uncomfortable. Yeah.
And I have a theory, and I'd love your perspective on it too. I think it's really couched in our own relationship to money and what it means to us. If you're coming from a place, particularly if maybe you had modest circumstances coming up, you attach so much meaning to money. Maybe you're uncomfortable with money. Maybe there's some trauma associated with money. And so because you make the money mean so much, that stands in the way of true human connection, because in your mind, you're just like, okay, if this person has more money, somehow they, I don't know, have more power over me or whatever it is. From someone who was like middle class to significant capacity, like what kind of money shifting did you have to do in your own mind about your relationship to money?
It was interesting. I'll start off with what my kids did. I had two kids in their 20s and one was a teenager at that point. And we've always been, I would say, involved in social justice from a mindset, not as much from money, but we went on our walks for raising money for whatever and that kind of thing. And they were incredibly uncomfortable with money to the point where they didn't want it. They wanted it to go away. And that was really shocking to me. That is like the complete absolute flip side of that whole thing. You don't want people to be a jerk, but to just say, I just want to not be here. Both of my older kids have been involved in resource generation, which you're probably familiar with. And there are people there who think that, but there's also a lot of people who are like, let's do really good work with this. And my son actually facilitates one of their praxis groups, one of their key areas, Indigenous people. That was weird. For Josh and I to see that was like opened our eyes. I don't understand that. Can you explain that? The biggest thing that happened to me is people pandering to us, people saying things like, I love your glasses. I love your this. I love your that. And I thought, if I was just a person you met at the liquor store, or whatever, at school, would you really say that to me? And it was very uncomfortable for me. And my husband said I was really naive because he thought it got to this point where everybody basically, I think a lot of donors feel this, where you don't trust anything that the fundraiser says to you. And that was really uncomfortable. I wanted to get to know these people. And it was only recently where I also learned that fundraisers are told not to talk about themselves. And I can't sit with somebody, and I suspect you're the same way, and not ask them anything about themselves. I just can't do that. But then they didn't want to tell me. And I thought, why? And I found out they'd actually been instructed to not tell me about themselves. As much as I think the concept is that donors are these scary outsider weird people or something, just another group of people that is that you can't really understand and you shouldn't get too close to. It was very strange to hear that I couldn't treat the fundraiser like a human being as well. I still do this all the time. And I find that especially newer fundraisers, they're really shocked when I say, really, tell me about yourself. Tell me where you grew up. Tell me whatever. Now I can say this. I know you might've been told not to talk about yourself, but I, as a donor, think it's important that we get to know each other on a relationship kind of level, as opposed to this transactional thing. Because otherwise you're just waiting for the person to ask you for money. And so we'll have a conversation and you keep saying to yourself, is this fake? Is it real? Is it fake? Is it real? And the reason people say I'm naive is I do actually think half the time that at least that it is a real conversation, unless I have a reason not to believe it. I'm developing a relationship here. This is really nice. And then when they ask me for money at the very end, and if I say, gee, I'm not sure, and I watch their face drop and they get ready to leave. I just told someone this the other day. I said, do you realize when you asked me that way after having a lovely conversation and then you said at the end, this is somebody I counsel a lot. I said, do you realize that I then lose all belief that was a real conversation? It becomes like that was just a method to get me to where you wanted to get me. I said to this woman, I know you're real. I know that was an authentic conversation, but it instantly hits me. It's like a knife hit me that said, nope, don't think that was real because somebody's actually BSing you again, just trying to get money out of you.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So much to unpack here. In my own personal fundraising, like I was never properly taught how to fundraise. So I just did what I do and it was successful most of the time. Some of the time it wasn't, right? But I approached it like a human being. I'm just a person. You're just a person. I'm doing this thing. If you want to do this thing together, let's do this thing. And it actually ended up being successful. And so I'm on this single woman mission to ditch the pitch because when I started to get fundraising training, it just didn't feel right to me. Like you have to have a pitch to go in. I was like, I don't talk like that. I don't want people to talk to me like that. Why are we being trained to do this thing that feels so unnatural?
I totally agree. And ditch the pitch. I hope I can. Can I use that?
Please ditch the pitch. Hashtag y'all ditch the pitch. Because it's a conversation, right?
It is a conversation. And then you have to get in. So if you ditch the pitch, I have had some people where I've said, just say what you think and what you feel. And I said, the most important, a lot of people say to me, well, I am uncomfortable asking about money, which then makes me think, but you're a fundraiser, but okay, that seems a little strange to me. But what I've said to them, and I'm actually about to write an article on this, is that if you actually develop a relationship with somebody and not just who you are, but why are you in this very difficult job? Why are you working for this organization? Showing that you have a passion for this particular cause. I always say, if you're a fundraiser and you in a fundraising position and you don't have passion about what the organization does, then you shouldn't be in that position. But when I find out if someone's really passionate, they're able to describe this with me. In fact, I'm doing a conference next week for an organization that has hundreds of organizations under them or with them that are all based on people who really don't know about fundraising, but who have a relative or a child in some cases who's had some very rare disease. So this is where they all come together and learn about fundraising. I don't think they have to play the games. I think they just say, this is really heartfelt. This is what I am. This is how I got into this. This is important. This is going to save lives of just not my kid, but other people. And most donors, and I truly believe this, I'd love to hear if you do, but I think most donors at that point, if you've had an authentic conversation, you won't have to ask for money as a fundraiser because the donor will say, oh my gosh, how can I help? I've told that idea to a number of people and they're like, but that's so easy. I don't know if I could, if that works that way. Just try it. It works.
Yeah. But let's go back because actually I've also been in the experience too of developing the relationship and then I get friend zoned. I've developed the relationship so much that the donor actually just thinks that we're just friends. And then because now I feel like I can't ask because we've developed this relationship where it's like friendly. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that because I think there's a fine balance here. Like you don't want to make it super transactional. Like I'm listening to you in order to get the gift, right? You do want to be genuine. But on the other hand, you are ultimately there to close a gift, right? How do you manage that tension?
Yeah, it's very interesting you said that because I got an email last night from a friend of mine out of the country who I had that conversation with. And so she would say, this is my job. Do you think you could contribute to this thing in the conversation? Because we became friends. I don't even think I guess she approached me as a fundraiser, but it also just seemed like a really nice person. I'd been to her home and whatever. She was talking the other day and she said, I need to ask you for money. And it was pretty quick. It wasn't like hi, how are you? Can you give? And it was a large amount of money, way more than I've ever given before to any of her organizations, which usually, you know, modest, decent sized gifts. And I had that feeling again. And I said, this is really awkward. And she knew it because we've become friends at this point. So she sent an email the other day and she said, look, I've been staying away for a while. I felt really badly about all of this. You know, can we have a conversation? And can you join back in some of our activities? And here's some of the things we're doing. And if you say no, so I could tell she was just as uncomfortable about it as I was. I think that what I'm going to tell her, because I actually was planning on calling her today after looking at the email, is that it's okay to ask for money. I know that's your business, but then you just need to say exactly what you just said, Ria, which is, this is my job. I have an obligation. Someone said this to me the other day. I have an obligation in this, what I do for a living, to ask you for money. If I don't, like someone said to me the other day, I had a similar thing and they said, it's our job not to leave a stone unturned. So if we're talking to you anyway, we really, it is our obligation to do it. Totally cool. But the thing that I suggest people do to make it work, I do this with a friend of mine at one of the big organizations that I'm on the board of. And he and I made a deal several years ago because I literally said, I can't tell when we're having a friend conversation or a fundraising or you're asking me for money. He came up with this idea, which I use all the time now. And he said, here's the deal. I will let you know when we set up the appointment if I'm going to be asking you for money or not. And I will be really clear about it. And you'll know, is this a fundraiser one or is this not? And he's done that now for, gosh, probably 7-8 years. It works perfectly. I know what I'm getting into. And then I'm agreeing to the meeting and I know what's going to happen. And you can say, I want to talk to you about supporting our organization because, I mean, you can, but you shouldn't, because I don't know what that means. Does that mean you want me to introduce you to somebody? Does that mean you want somebody to get somebody to give you something for your silent auction? Or does that mean money? And it couldn't be any of those. And so you need to actually say, you don't have to say I'm asking you for a gift. You can just say, I want to talk to you about financially supporting. Or if we're good friends, I'm going to be asking you for money. That's what I'm going to be doing. Okay. And I know going in exactly what that conversation is going to be. And then nothing feels fake to me. It literally is that one little piece makes it all feel like, oh, I can be a friend and be a donor for you on your business side at the same time.
Yeah, I love that so much because it really just goes to my core belief of this is just about trust, right? You just treat people and you let them know which story they're in. Because I think exactly to your point, it's like, wait, am I on this like fundraising story? Am I on a friend's story? I love a dating analogy. I'm like, look, are we building something here or are we just like playing around? Which is fine, but just like, tell me which track I'm on.
Yeah, exactly right. I think it's exactly what it is. And it's really kind of an easy fix, I think. I wish everybody would do it. And people, I have to say some fundraisers I've talked to are really afraid to do that. Yeah. It's don't be afraid because that it automatically says, not only should we trust each other, but that I'm authentic and I want to have an authentic relationship with you and I'm not going to play games. It's going to be real. And then you say, that is so great that you were upfront with me. I trust you now. And then I'm going to listen to what they say.
That's right. Can we talk about amounts? So I know this is a thing that like people get their panties in a bunch about, like, how much do I ask for? And my thought, and I'd love your perspective on this, is if you are unsure about the amount, like you haven't spent enough time in the relationship, because once I get to know you, once I get to know what you're passionate about, once I get to know the size of the gifts that you generally make, then I'll have an idea of what to ask for. And sometimes I've seen situations in which people are pushed to ask for ridiculous sums. And I'm like, where did you get that number? Like Wall Street told me that they could give $1 million. I'm like, but what did the conversations tell you? What are your perspectives about asking for a specific amount and what it takes to right size that?
So excellent question. So first of all, number one is do not trust Wealth Engine as your 100% thing. Just do not.
I know. I tell people this all the time. I'm like, it is a data point. It is not the data point. And P.S., right. Especially for like people living in L.A., New York, San Francisco, the wealth screens are totally off. It's, yeah, you have $1 million house, but please continue. Please.
Oh, you're 100% right. And one thing I suggest is that everybody does a wealth screen on themselves. And you will see if you want to do it on a friend, as long as they say it's okay, you could do that. Mine was 95% wrong. There was almost nothing that was accurate. And most of it was built on my own bio that they put a piece in a vat, which I'd written myself. And that's coming back to it just was crazy. I really think that is damaging. And I think the trust in those numbers as being, like you said, the only data point is ridiculous. A lot of organizations, even there's some consulting firms who will go through and do a capacity study for you for an annual large fundraising thing that you're doing. They will come back to you with the following information. And I'm sure most of you know this, not always, but a lot of them, I see this a lot. One is what political party these people are in. The second one is what, and these are already people who are your people who are engaged with your organization. They'll tell you political party, political donations, and value of your home. And you already talked about the value of your home thing, which just doesn't mean anything. It's crazy. It might mean how you can manipulate money to make it look like you have more money. It can also mean it just isn't enough. It isn't at all enough. But the political party thing drives me crazy because if they're already engaged with your organization, who cares what their political party is? Like, why is that important information to decide how much you're going to ask them for? And then the amount that they gave to political campaigns is capped. So that doesn't make any sense either. That's why I love some of these other companies. Market Smart is one that it's who introduced us and who really look at other kinds of things about that person and look at them as a whole person. I think it's crazy. I also have had that experience. There's one in the book about me giving a certain amount. I'll say I did a 5-figure gift for a few years and then was asked for a 7-figure gift immediately afterwards. And I thought, like, did I do something to make you think that? I think it's exactly what you said. I think somebody said, the wealth screen says blah, 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 blah. Or they gave this amount to somebody, therefore they're going to give this to us, which kind of falls from the same category of let's just call the Gates Foundation and tell them we're wonderful and ask them for money. There's no meaning to it. My favorite way of figuring out if, unless you've been told by somebody you have to go get this money, is, and really by checking that, is to give somebody a menu of different kinds of things that they can give. And you say, what are these kinds? And they did this, by the way, at Cedars-Sinai when we gave our money, to try and point out to us that we didn't have enough money because they didn't believe that we didn't have enough money to give them because we weren't in Wellsprings yet because we were new. They said, and they were trying to have me say, oh, and instead I said, oh yeah, okay. There's, and so it's like, you could do this for this and this for this and this for this money. And it was a wide range. And I got to say, yeah, okay, any of these would be fine. Or this sounds the most interesting. And that's some really good guidance if you show that to people. Like what, and if the person says something and it was like $10 million or whatever, I'd say, hey, that's just not my thing. I don't give that much. And I would say that. That went over the top. And so let's go look. And you can even say, when you give to organizations, are you giving in this range or that range? Totally cool to ask me that. I have no problem with that. Because you know why? That's them asking to understand me better. And so they get points just for asking that question because it shows I want to have a relationship with you. I want authenticity in this relationship.
Let's talk about that because we talk a lot about building relationships with donors. And I think we can talk about statistically how bad our retention rates are. That's a whole other topic. What I found, especially in areas like New York, San Francisco, LA, is that with donors, they've become cynical, right? Because I think in many ways they have felt used and abused, let's say. For the fundraiser who's out here really wanting to build an authentic relationship, how do you pierce the veil of cynicism, which like I don't blame donors for because they have been networked to death and manipulated. If I'm coming with this understanding of I'm here to build a relationship, I'm here to build trust, I'm here to be authentic and straightforward, but I'm being held at an arm's length because my donor has been mistreated so many times. Like, what does one do about that?
Yeah, I think the first thing to do if you've got somebody like that is, and I think most donors have some feeling of that. It's just there's a whole spectrum, right? But find somebody that you have in common. It's really what we do on social media all the time, right? Find somebody that you have in common that will automatically offset. It won't completely offset, but it will lessen that sort of, oh no, stay away from me kind of thing. Because there's always this, well, okay, if you're friends with whoever, or I could say, let's say you don't find somebody in common as a contact, but that they were at some event and you're like, hey, you know what? I was at that event too. I was involved in, or I have another donor who was there and said it was great. Tell me about that event. And that tells that person that A, you've done your homework. I can't stand when somebody comes to me and hasn't done the homework. And literally I've had fundraisers say, so where's your money from? Which is really like, that's not a great way to start a conversation, but where they really don't know anything about me as a person. And the more that you want to know about that person, some people say to me, well, I don't want to do that because it's weird to do a Google search on somebody. But you can't get into a college without someone doing a Google search on you now. That's just part of what people do. So just don't worry about it. I expect that a fundraiser who's approaching me knows something about me, knows something about the kinds of things I give to, and ideally extra points if you know somebody in common. So I think that will offset that issue. And then if you start off and say, I want to talk to you, and this will not be about fundraising. And this is great. If you say, I'm not going to ask you for money, I just want to talk to you about our organization and let you know about it and see how you feel about some things that we do, I will go into the meeting and I will be waiting to see, can they actually honor what they just said? Or are they just not going to be able to help themselves and they're going to ask me for money? And when I get up at the end of it or end it on Zoom or whatever, and they haven't asked me for money, then I'm good. Then then all of a sudden I feel like, okay, they told me what they were going to do or what they were not going to do. They honored that. We had a nice conversation and let's go have the next meeting and let's talk some more about it. I don't think they're tricks, but there are little things that you can do to offset that issue.
One of the things that I know that you are passionate about, I read your blog post on it, and I completely agree, is that our lack of patience is really leaving money on the table. And I think in part, we're under these pressures, and especially if you have a board, it's like you need to bring in the money. We rush the relationship. We rush the conversation. We ask too early, or in some cases, we ask too late. But I think when we get into this like transactional thing of, okay, I'm going to have a conversation with Lisa, and then I'm going to convert it into a gift, it really gets us into this transactional mindset. I'm just curious, like, your thoughts about taking time with relationships.
Yeah. So that is a really big issue. The ask for money, I think, has to be done at an appropriate time. I think that it's if you have the relationship, I do believe you'll know when it's appropriate. But if you have a real relationship, you can be honest and you can just ask, is this time to ask you for money? The problem that we have is that a lot of people are being sent in by their boards, by their superiors, by whatever, saying, just bring back the check, which drives me up a wall. If you do that, and a lot of people do, and you can't, sometimes you just can't help it because that's your boss and you've got to do what what they say, and or that's the board. And I've sent my books to a number of boards, and I've talked to a lot of boards because I want to make it clear to them that's not healthy. That's not healthy for your organization. And if you need the money right now, then it doesn't even show that you have a plan being even in some way sustainable in the future. It sounds like, oh no, it sounds, I want to get you into this scam really fast, even though I'm not suggesting that any of these nonprofits are scams, but sort of feels like it feels like I need the money and I need it now. And the thing that I find really interesting is that I didn't realize that fundraisers think the donors know when they give once, they are expected to give annually. I never knew that. And no one ever told me that. I had to learn it from getting behind the scenes here. And I'm telling you that most donors have no idea. They also don't know, and this is the really unfortunate part, is that you're supposed to give more every year. You're supposed to give the same amount and then more. Nobody tells you those rules. And that's why I have a book coming out now and another one I'm starting to write called The Donor's Handbook. So donors know, what are the rules? You don't have to abide by them. You should at least know, what are these fundraisers being told at their organizations? And so when someone says, what's our annual fund? I never had anyone explain to me what an annual fund was, other than that's a way of me asking you for money more often. I don't know what those different things are, but people are really shocked when I tell them that you don't realize. Like, I think I gave you money. And the next year someone says, this is my favorite one. This happens all the time. We want to see if you could increase your annual gift. And that's a whole lot to unpack, just that statement, because I never said I was giving you an annual gift. I didn't know I was supposed to give you an annual gift. And now you're asking me to increase something that I didn't even say I was going to do. And I get asked that a lot. I used to just say, that's a really crazy thing to say. Now I'll say back to them, you know what? Let's talk about what you just said to me, because it doesn't work. I do think that this idea of you have to give and give now, and you're expected to give every year. And by the way, if you don't give more, you're disappointing me. And a lot of times I can tell that a fundraiser is disappointed because I gave them the same amount the next year. I think that's just cruel, actually. I think that's a real problem with our industry. And I think it's that kind of attitude that makes people not want to give again to the same organization.
Let us talk about upgrading, because that is the idea behind it. If you're constantly stewarding your donors to upgrade, when is it appropriate to consider an upgrade? Because the thing that we also know is that many times people will give an introductory gift just to see what you do with it. And then if you steward it properly, then they're open for a further conversation. Curious about your perspective there.
Yeah, they will. But what do you do when somebody gives you $1 million as an unsolicited first gift? Are you automatically expected to ask them for $1.5 million the next year? It depends, right? And this is all about that donors aren't this monolithic thing, right? We're all different. And so I think it has to do a lot with what those donations are. And yes, if you believe that person is checking you out with this smaller gift, great. Then you can just say, hey, want to show you what we're doing, some of these things. Do you think you might, would you be interested in helping us with some of these larger kinds of things where we actually have greater needs, or we have some of these areas? I think a lot of it is letting people know what are the pieces that are going to, that you do in terms of your impact that resonate with that donor. If that storytelling is a part of the conversation, then again, it's just give me money. And then somebody told me, I forgot the term the other day, it was something like shut up money, that basically that people are just, sometimes donors will just say, forget it, I'll just give you money to go away money. That's what they call it, go away money.
Oh, it's funny. I call it mariachi money. Like when you give the mariachi band like some money, just, okay, please go do that somewhere else.
I just can't bear it anymore. Here you go. But who wants to have an organization that has donors who are giving them money to go to mariachi money or to go away? And if you have a relationship, you've taken the time to have a relationship with that person, you will know when they're starting to talk about go away money, because you'll have that conversation. So it's really getting rid of this fear of money and work fear of these people that, like, what are we going to do to you? Are we going to like hurt you? Like I said, there's a few bad donors out there who do crazy things, but most donors just want to be partners with an organization and do good things in the world. That's really what I'm guessing 90-something% of donors want to do.
Yeah. Last question for me, because we have to wrap up, but I could talk to you forever. When I was fundraising in New York, there was like this real tit for tat sort of situation where it's like my board member got their friend to give because they gave to their pet cause. And I just was never really sure what to do with that, because I'm like, okay, this person is giving because their board member, my board member gave to their cause. So that indicates to me that maybe they're not really invested in the cause, but is there a potential for me to have a conversation, get them more invested? But I wasn't really sure what to do with that. What's your perspective on that?
So just make sure I got this right. So somebody brings a friend to their table or whatever,
right,
and they make a show. And then what do you do with them? Yeah. So I think that that's a question. I think you say, look, is this something that you're interested in learning more about? By the way, I have been to a bunch of those, and obviously, and maybe 1% of the time has somebody even followed up with me. They just follow. The only follow up is give us more money. There's never a follow up of, hi, did you enjoy it? What did you like about it? Is that a cause that you're interested in? Never, ever happens. It just doesn't happen. People don't do that. The next thing I hear from them is give me more money. And that's just not okay. I think a little easy reach out somehow saying, and you can send this as a bulk thing to people and just as a bulk email that has everybody's individual name on their email. You're just, hey, thanks so much for coming. I've never gotten this. Thank you for coming to our event. We know that you were the guest of whatever, and we're so happy that they brought you. And we would love to know what you thought of the event. I'm guessing you go to a lot of them, and we'd love to know what you thought and what you think about the cause now that you know a little bit about it. Would you like to know more? That would be awesome. No one's ever done it. It's not to me.
Yeah. And I think the thing that you're signposting here, which I want everybody who's listening to hear this, is creating a mechanism for a dialogue. Because oftentimes, as nonprofits, we're just like throwing tennis balls into a vacuum cleaner, right? We're just like pitching it out and we're not inviting a conversation. Greg Warner talked about this, creating surveys, sitting with your donors, asking questions, doing donor interviews, really genuinely coming from a place of curiosity and wanting to connect versus extraction and how can I pitch you on that thing? There's no magical combination of words that you can say that is going to induce somebody to donate.
That's right. And that's why I suggest that every nonprofit do a survey at least once a year to their database and ask them, how would they like to be referred to? Because people are particular about that. And if you're referring to them in a way that they don't like to be referred to and all the, your information, I get stuff all the time to my email, but only inviting my husband, which is lovely. I got one yesterday. So that, and, but how do you like to be referred to? And you just answer. It's like if you do it on a free survey online on MailChimp or something. Anyway, and then the other question you ask them is, how do you like to be thanked? Everybody knows how they want to be thanked, but there's a spectrum. The other thing you want to ask them is, how often do you want to be notified of our impact and the good work that we're doing? Most people would want to be notified not in an annual report once a year. Most people want to be notified as it happens or once a month or something, like here's some successes. A few different people I know have sent this out. Maybe they added into some specific questions. Maybe they have 10 questions. Quick and dirty, takes you 3 minutes to do it because everybody knows how they want to be thanked, how they want to be referred to, how often they want to know about impact. And what happens though, on the side of this, people who I know who've done this, is that the donors then will send them more money without them asking because they're so shocked that somebody's asking me about me as an individual. And that is a way of using a mass market survey to make someone feel like they're an individual. And it's very effective. Even I was surprised when I knew people would feel better about it, but I didn't know that they would actually send money. And one person sent an email to this friend of mine's organization and said, I didn't know you people cared. And that's just those easy little things that you can do. It really works.
Yeah. And I, again, cannot just emphasize this enough that you have to tell people what you did with their money. Tell them the impact it made before you even think about asking again, because then you just become the annoying teenager who only comes around when you need money. And no one likes that teenager.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah, thanks.
Lisa, thank you so much for all that you're doing. Tell us a little bit about what's up next for you. I know you mentioned you have a new book coming out. Where can folks learn about that? I know you have a great blog. Like, how can people connect with you if they want more Lisa in their life?
Sure. Well, thank you. So my paperback came out in the UK. If any of you were on here from the UK, it came out last week, Philanthropy Revolution. The paperback version can be pre-ordered now on Amazon in the US. And I have a new book coming out. You can't pre-order it quite yet, but soon, called The Fundraiser's Handbook. It's meant to be specifically for fundraisers so that you can get smart on some subject like donor advised funds very quickly and in a very kind of short to the point way. And so that will be coming out in the spring or midsummer, I think it is at this point. So I do have a blog. I write. And thank you for referring to that. It's called Philanthropy 451. It comes out every 2 weeks and you can get to it by going to lisagreer.com. You can sign up right there on the front page. And then we have a premium version that you can pay a small amount for. And then we have a talk like this kind of thing, but much more interactive once a month. And then I also do a tip of the week that shows up on Twitter X and on LinkedIn, which is just some very short little tip that will help people. And so basically it's all about just trying to figure out how to help people. That's what I do. And we would certainly love to talk to and see all of you.
Fantastic. I'll make sure to put all of the info in the show notes for folks listening on the podcast. But in the meantime, Lisa, thank you for all of the work that you're doing. I look forward to many more conversations. We'll have to have you back on the pod when your book publishes. And if you're in New York and do a salon, let me know.
Absolutely. We'll do it. Thanks. Take care, everybody.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, rate and review and share it because it helps other folks to learn more. Thanks so much. Have a great day.